It was something, you know, that you did to become part of the gang. Mm-hmm. And especially as a Jewish boy, you know, it wasn't easy. There were many, many vicious remarks. Of course, they were just stupidly made. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing to reflect upon is, of course, that they came from these people, these kids' homes, right?
Right.
In fact, the story that I don't recall myself, but my parents told me about many times, my mother, when I was 3 in McKees Rocks, she was giving me a bath one day, and I asked her if I had killed Jesus Christ. That was at the age of 3. I had no knowledge of any of this. In the lower hill, there were, you know, I can't tell you that I was picked on, because I could handle myself. I wasn't the toughest kid on the block, but I wasn't the sissy. And after a while, when you're part of the gang and you play ball with everybody, then there might be some stupid remarks, mm-hmm. but you know, you learn to live with it. And some of them, they might have been directed by an Irishman against an Italian, or an Italian against an Irishman, just as well as against
right.
a Jew. They were just things that kids called themselves.
Did you fight?
Sure, there were a lot of fights, but not the kind of a situation, you know, where I can say, like some of the Jewish kids in parts of Brooklyn or New York had to fight their way home. It wasn't that kind of a situation. But sure, there were occasional fights with the dirty Jew business and this and that. But once, you know, you became part of the group, and then after a while, I was always president of my class every year at Forbes School, and president of my class every year at Fifth Avenue High School. I played ball on the streets, and then, you know, I played ball with the kids at the high school. And by the way, let me tell you that in the 5 years I was at Fifth Avenue High School, I don't remember one ugly racial incident. Here again,
really?
There were some remarks once uh-huh. in a while, and there was a majority of blacks, and yet I was elected president of the class each year, and we never had a, you know, there was not, it's very interesting to reflect on the difference between
right.
then and today. And again, you know, it was part of, you know, working, being with the kids, the ball field and the orchestra and student activities, as limited as they were. You know, we weren't the Taylor Alderdice or a school like that. So we
was
had very
too,
limited
Dr.
functions.
Webb, that maybe you kind of expected at that time. We expect different things today from people, hopefully, in terms of understanding differences. But maybe the other was that new people around felt, well, this is to be expected, no use to get excited about it.
Yes, I do agree that that is a difference in attitude, and attitude obviously influences, if indeed may not even predetermine perception, and perception, expectation, anticipation can sometimes be more relevant and meaningful than reality. But what I mean by that little bit of philosophy is this, pursuant to your very interesting question. Today, parents and other people probably then in the community would be less tolerant and less accepting of those kinds of things. And it was considered pro forma. It was just part of the milieu
yes.
in which you grew up. Today, these things would not be socially acceptable and so on. Not that it was ever considered nice to call someone a kike or a wop or a mick or a nigger, but those words I think were not as insulting,
mm-hmm.
and not as socially unacceptable as they are today. You know, whether that's good or bad, that's a subject for another day.
Yes.
But you're quite right. They existed, and it was probably considered, you know, just part of the culture, as these families, many of them were first and some second generation.
That's right,
and
they
so
were
on.
New to the
And the country. Whole business of political correctness was yet to be invented.
Right,
you know,
right. Let me go back.
It was a phrase that nobody had ever used, I guess.
Right. Let me go back 1 minute. What happened to your violin? Did you, even though you stopped for medical school?
It's a good question.
School,
I continued through college and a little bit in the medical school, and regrettably have not continued with it through the years because I have been so busy. I have three violins at home. Two are quite good. Two are Italian violins. They're not Stradivarii or Amati or Tononi, but I remember the other two names, Amati and Tononi. Everybody knows Stradivarius. I have these violins at home. I have just, and it always pains me and angers me inside at myself when I'm asked a question, I think, you know, that I haven't kept up with it. And
you
I
don't
guess
do
it's
it
rationalization in a while, in a way, because one finds time, and I've, you know, found time to do everything else. So maybe it can be said that I did not love it, and it would be true that I did not love it to, you know, to the degree that I would have pursued it at the expense of something else.
I can
honestly say, and it is not, I'm not rationalizing or deceiving myself or anybody else, and I have had a pretty busy schedule.
Right.
I was in medical school, I worked at hospitals, and the internship was a full-time operation. And then when I started my residency, I also started law school, and I also started working moonlighting at hospitals in the evenings from 6 until 7:30, and then would go directly to my residency and on weekends. And then that continued, and it's always been, you know, two, three, four, five, six things at the same time. So, you know, it's never like I just go home, why don't you in your free time? You know, there really is no such thing. I made free time for my family.
Right.
And I feel great about that I did not let those years go by without doing things for my kids or going to see them play ball and so on and so forth. So the important things, my family and our enjoyment and doing things together, I did not. And I don't mean to boast, but I am very proud of that. But I just, you know, aside from those things, I don't have idle time, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
it wasn't a form of relaxation where you're tied up and you say, I'm going to pick up my violin and
exactly.
relax.
Exactly. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. And then we had four kids. The boys were, you know, what they call Irish triplets, about a year and a half apart from each other. And, you know, and then my daughter 3 years later. So with the four kids and my wife and the house, and then the politicking kicked in and so on, there just wasn't time. I feel sad, and I say to myself, will I ever get to it when I retire? And maybe I will. I still have a lot of good music, and I have my music stand, and I may even have my metronome. I don't know whether I will or not.
Tell me, when you were in growing up, was there any, did your parents attend or belong to a synagogue?
Yes, we belonged to the synagogue through all the years up in the Hill District. I think it was Beth Jacob. I think it's one of the constituent shuls of the synagogue that's up here on Caldwell Street.
Right.
It was up in the hill. I think it was on, might have been on Epiphany Street. You could check. It was just across the street from Kelson's Bathhouse. That I remember.
I remember.
Because I went to Kelson's Bathhouse when I became a teenager with my father on Saturday nights. Oh. That was a treat for me. 11:30, I would finish practicing. He would close the store. We would go up there, and I would go into the Schwitz. And would order out corned beef sandwiches. I was reminiscing the other day with Harry Kelson, who is the son of one of the brothers that owned the place. He comes to the Jewish Center, and we were reminiscing about those days. And there were two things that I always wanted to do that I never got to do. One was to get a massage. I saw these men getting massages.
Yeah.
And the other thing was to sleep overnight. The people, you know,
instead
of going, well, on the cold winter night, well, they had beds there, sure, because don't forget, these were the Jewish hucksters and so on that came in from all the small towns. They would come in. They weren't the people from Squirrel Hill or Oakland or so on. They went home. And my father knew better, sure. But it was a cold night, you know, let's say it was in the wintertime, and that's usually when you would go. And, you know, the idea, I was tired, I was a kid, but I love the Schwitz. So the synagogue, Beth Jacob, was there, and we belonged there. However, and I was, that's where I was bar mitzvah. But my big party on Sunday night was at Beth Sholem, because we had a lot of people, and I gave a whole concert. That was my father.
Really?
Yeah, that was. I gave it a recital. I played for more than an hour. I had a marvelous woman who was a good friend of my violin teacher's. She lived in Wilkinsburg. I saw she just died recently. Helen Schwab, S-C-H-W-A-B.
Oh, yes.
She was a marvelous, what a lady. And she was my accompanist. And she accompanied me everywhere on all of the, you know, everything. I played, you know, all these little Fritz Kreisler pieces and Kol Nidre and Hebrew melody and so on and so forth. So I gave this whole recital, and
wow.
I'm sure that's why my father had the party out there.
I was going to say you were rather conforming.
But sure, because we lived down in the hill, and we went. And we continued then at Beth Jacob, you know, I don't remember until when.
But you didn't go further on in your studies, Hebrew studies?
No, I did not. And, you know, and I had a marvelous Hebrew. You know who my Hebrew teacher was? Oliver Goldsmith, who was Ethel Smith's father. Now, Ethel Smith, the organist, is married to Ralph Bellamy. He was a fine gentleman. And he was my Hebrew teacher. And he trained me for my bar mitzvah. I did not, regrettably. My kids did. You know, my kids then all continued on. They all had bar mitzvahs, studied with Saul Abrams and Kamenetsky and that whole crew at the Hebrew Institute. And my daughter had her bat mitzvah there. And then they all continued at Sages. And my eldest son, David, speaks fluent Hebrew.
Beautiful.
The others took the Jewish studies program. David took the Hebrew stuff. But we didn't have that. And
You didn't have Hebrew classes at Beth Jacob. You had a tutor.
If there were, I had a tutor, came to my home.
Yeah, but no Hebrew classes with
groups. I did not go to Hebrew school because I was playing the violin. Some of the other kids went to Hebrew school. I went and played the violin. My father was more
really
interested
funny.
In the violin than the Hebrew classes. However, there was never any question about our, you know, our Jewishness, you know, and that's, you know, the same thing today. I regret that I did not learn to speak Hebrew. I've been to Israel many times, probably 8 to 10 times. I have relatives there, and cousins whom I've become close to, and my aunt and uncle before they died. My son David, he's been there even more times, and all my kids have been there 2-3 times, and my wife a few times. But I regret that I did not learn to speak Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that I knew more as a religious scholar, and I would love to have studied the Talmud too, but you know, these are as on an intellectual basis.
Right, right.
We're not Orthodox. We don't keep a kosher house, but it's very Jewish. And you know.
Did your parents attend services other than
Yom Tov?
Just
on holidays.
Just the
Yom Tov. Just on holidays.
I see. Did they continue that once they moved out of the
Yes,
hill?
Yes, we did on the holidays. Mm-hmm. We would go, even though. We became members at Rosh Hashanah, where we were married, my wife Sigrid and I, by Rabbi Freehoff. And so we became members there. One of my oldest and best friends was Victor Cavalier.
Oh, yes.
And I guess that's how we gravitated to Rosh Hashanah in the first place. We're not members there now, but we were. But even though we were members through all those years, my kids preferred Hebrew Institute because
right.
they thought it was more serious.
In terms of
Hebrew and more intense, yeah. And to their credit, they all, that was their decision. After going to, Sunday school or whatever in the Rosh Hashanah, they just didn't think it was very serious.
Now, your parents are gone?
Yes, my mother died in 1980. She was almost 75, and my father had died in 1976. He was almost 80.
Just a year apart?
Four years apart. He died in 76, and my mother died in 80.
Oh, in 80.
80, yeah.
So she,
yeah.
Were they both ill at that time? Was it illness?
For a while, not one of those protracted illnesses. Both developed some basic heart ailments.
I see.
My mother had breast cancer, but she survived that, and she had no cancer when she died. She had had surgery two different times. But then she developed some heart problems. And so they did not, you know, linger real long. Fortunately, you know, I mean, did not suffer. My father a little bit longer, and we even brought a hospital bed home for a while. But that was a matter of, you know, a couple months or so. He could get up a little bit, but he was in congestive heart failure. And then they passed away. My mother's death was somewhat more sudden and unexpected. She was living in the Wendover Apartments. It was a Saturday morning, and we couldn't get her on the phone. And I was, in fact, I was down here in the coroner's office, and they called my son, David. They went over, and I had to break the door down. It was a Saturday. It was in May. I remember it was the day he was graduating from Shadyside Academy. It was that evening he was having his prom, which, of course, he then did not go to. I remember it so vividly. My father went back into Central Medical Hospital where I was, and he died at the hospital. That was, you know, more expected because he just began to slip. But they had enjoyed, you know, basically good health, the usual ailments and so on, but did not suffer from diabetes or high blood pressure.
And your mother moved into an apartment after your
Wendover,
father died.
She sold a house on Whiteman Street, not immediately.
I see.
But she moved into the Wendover, and then she, before the Wendover, she lived in the building above the Parkway Pharmacy on Hobart. Is it called Parkway Pharmacy? It's on the corner of Hobart and Whiteman. There's a drugstore and a dry cleaners. It's a small building. Yeah, that's right. She lived there for a while. Then she moved across the street to the Wendover. That was it, because it was at the Wendover where she died. So that's how I remember the sequence. Yeah. So the house was just a half a block down on Whiteman by Wendover Street. So, yeah, she sold the house then because there was nobody else, you know, there.
And, what was your mother's maiden name?
Rubenstein. Oh. Yeah, Rubenstein.
With a...
I-N-S-T-I. You know, I'm going to check that with Blanche. She would know. Blanche is my cousin in Pittsburgh, and she has a good memory of all these things. Mm-hmm. She's older than I by, 10, 12 years, so mm-hmm. she remembered things from childhood. Mm-hmm. I'll check. I should know that. I think it was Rubinstein. Yeah, Rubinstein. Mm-hmm.
So she was in an apartment when she died. So
when she
was
died
in
by
a
herself, yeah, right.
Thick,
yeah.
In a heart condition.
Yeah, no, she lived and she handled everything by herself. In fact, when the kids would be here in the summer, they'd come back, and the boys when they were older, a little. My wife would be with the kids at the shore in Connecticut. We were placed there in Long Island Sound outside New Haven. But as the boys got older in high school, and they had to come back for football practice in early August, and my wife would stay there with the younger kids, so my mother would usually have cooked supper for them every night and come there for football practice, and she would make the kinds of dinners that, you know, she had made for me, only in a little better quarters and a better kitchen. Yeah, that's right, so they had all that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, when your parents were in Squirrel Hill. Were they active in any of the organizations?
My mother, to the extent that the store time permitted, she was Pioneer Women was her number one organization, and Hadassah. I remember those very well. I think they belonged to others, but those were the two that my mother, you know, would do things in and try to go to meetings. My mother was much more of a social person in an organizational sense, and had she not had the store, and I think she would have been very active. But I remember, you know, her declining, having to decline different positions and so on, because she just did not have the time. And my mother never learned to drive. That was her fault, in a way. And so that handicapped her in later years then, because she did not have that kind of mobility. But those were her two organizations. My father belonged to a couple of groups, but he was never really active organizationally because he was always very busy. And then I was the other part of his life that he devoted to me, you know, because when I talk about my lessons and so on, he went with me. He took me. Drove me to Squirrel Hill. My teacher was located by the Waldorf Bakery. He drove me, you know, and from the, you know, and again, we didn't even have the parkway or the.
Right.
But, it was a schlep, you know, and so he went with me to those four lessons a week and all the practicing. So between the store and me, there really wasn't time for anything else.
Tell me in Mexico.
He had to go and buy his own stuff at the Strip and go to Oswald and Hess and Armour and Southside Packing to buy the meats. I remember going with him as a little boy and so on and so forth. It was a full-time job.
Did you ever work in the store?
A little bit. He did not want me to work in the store. And there wasn't any time between school and practicing.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, I didn't mind it, though. I mean, in fact, I would take my half-hour breaks and I would go out and wait on people and so on. I never learned to cut meat. But, you know, and sell the kids candy and this, and get groceries and so on and so forth. And I came to know the prices and ring up the cash register. So it wasn't a busy, busy store. You know what I mean? If you had three, four people at the same time, it was, you know, atypical. Usually, you know, somebody came in, somebody left, somebody else came in, you know.
Were summer camps part of your growing up?
No, only one time during the war years when travel was more or less restricted. I was very fortunate. My mother's younger sister had married a young man who came from New Haven, whom she met at Pitt Dental School. Uh-huh. And he went back to New Haven to practice dentistry. And so in the summertime, the sisters would all pitch in and rent a modest cottage at a place called Woodmont, W-O-O-D-M-O-N-T, Woodmont, which is a part of Milford, M-I-L-F-O-R-D, which is just before you get into New Haven, going up on 95. And this was the area where Jewish families from New Haven, some from Waterbury and Bridgeport, and would come. It was overwhelmingly Jewish.
Yes.
And these people would have their summer homes there. And that's where I became close friends over the years, my early teens, with people who today are my closest friends. One of my very dearest friends, we see always and travel with, and we're going to Norway together in a week, we're together a month in Italy, is Murray Lender from Lender's Bagels.
Oh.
And I used to make the run with Murray. His father came from Poland and made the bagels in the backyard of their home in New Haven, and wound up Murray and his brother Marvin, who was national president of UJA for a few years, they sold that to Kraft for $106 million. There's a real ratio. But anyway, Murray Lender and other people there are my closest friends. So the answer to your question is, no, I would go up in the summer for a short while. I wouldn't spend the whole summers because my father would not let me be away that long from the violin. In my teen years then, when I guess he recognized he had to loosen the reins a little bit, and he had a promise for me that I would practice, and I did take my violin, and I did practice, but not 4 hours a day. And I would go there, and then I would spend the whole summer. With my aunt, my mother would come up for a while. She could never spend the whole summer because she had to be here with my father. But, and then when I got married and took my wife there, and she liked it, and we both liked the beach and the ocean and the kids, so the answer to the question, then and we have a place there, another different from what we had, and my kids would spend their entire summers from the day after school and then until the day before school began. I only went to Iron Kaufman Sullivan Camp, Emma Kaufman Camp, what it was called, one time for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my only camping experience, except when I was a counselor in later years at a camp in Maine, just before I started medical school. But I love the beach and still do, and I love the freedom and
Tell me, when you were living in Lower Hill, do you remember what the Jewish community was like?
Yes, there were limited Jewish families down in the Lower Hill. I remember the families very well. The Barrent, Marvin Barrent, is a pharmacy now on Frankston Avenue. His sister Esther is still around in Pittsburgh too. She never married a lovely girl, Esther. So I remember the Barrents, B-A-R-E-N-T, he was a huckster. Reuben family, not many of them around. I can remember the individual names, because there were more Jews on the Upper Hill. Not a lot, but there were more. And they came down to Fifth Avenue High School. See, I didn't know them in Forbes. See, Forbes was limited. There were just very few Jewish families.
Yes.
Quite staggered. The Lower Hill was populated, I don't know how far back, Irish and Italians and so on. The Upper Hill was more of the Jewish enclave, which then became, then there were always, some Italian and Irish families and some Syrian Lebanese families, and that's where Sam Rainey's began and so on and so forth. And then the Jews began to move out. But and then the black and the blacks, of course, moved in. We did not have black families. The Lower Hill was just a different ethnic situation in the Lower Hill.
What constitutes the Lower Hill?
The Lower Hill was considered anything on this side of Fifth Avenue, between the Boulevard of the Allies and Fifth Avenue, was what was referred to as Uptown. And
right.
Politically, it's a subdivision. It was, you know, we were Ward 1.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of the hill, the other side of Fifth Avenue, was the 2nd Ward and the 3rd Ward, and then the 5th Ward, and so on. So the Lower Hill, as it was referred to, or Uptown, as it's
right.
still referred to, and so on.
Right.
And, you know, these are artificial boundaries. There's nothing
right.
official about that, except to some extent with the political subdivisions. But the Lower Hill was Fifth Avenue up to the Boulevard of the Allies,
uh-huh.
and pretty much from Brady Street into downtown. Brady Street into downtown, Brady Street and Kirkpatrick. That pretty much was
right.
it. And then on the other side of Fifth Avenue, all the way up through Center, Wiley, Webster, all the
where
Cliff
Ike's
Street,
was.
And so on, that was the Hill District.
And that was the mostly Jewish section.
There
near
were,
the
yeah,
Ike's.
That's where the Jews all came from,
right.
Who then moved to Oakland, East Liberty, and Squirrel Hill. Right.
Now, how about McKees Rocks? Was
oh, no,
a
that
Jewish
was
community?
No, no, very, very few Jews. There were a couple. One of the mayor of a very politically strong guy was Barney Hirschman. I remember Barney Hirschman. He's a name out of the past. If you talk to some of the old timers, I remember Barney Hirschman. I'm sure I remember his family. And one or two other families, but very, very few.
Few
Jews in McKees Rocks, very few. A couple of merchants. I'll tell you who else started in McKees Rocks. Silverman from the, you know, Jerry died a few years ago, right? They started, they're McKees Rocks folks, the Silverman family. They had a small men's store.
Yeah. Hirschman.
Oh, you are?
They are.
Oh, they are. Oh, they, yeah. So Silverman and Hirschman and, you know, maybe a couple of others, but they're the ones that I remember. There was a Sherman family. Yeah, that's a name I remember. A young man and a young woman who were, I think, a little bit older than I, but very, very few Jews. It was just, you know, that was the place that the store presented itself that my father could handle.
I see. That's why he took it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, yeah. But then you were in Oakland, too, at some point.
No, never Oakland.
Never
Oakland.
Oakland.
The Uptown from McKees Rocks, and then my parents bought the home on Whiteman Street,
yes,
which was the first home that they had ever owned. Well, they owned the store, and the house we lived in, or the apartment behind the store in McKees Rocks. In the Uptown, they had never bought a home. I guess the father did not want to invest
there. What was Squirrel Hill like when you moved there? Do you remember?
Oh, very much like it is today,
it is.
I guess. I don't, you know, I mean, things have changed, but I'm not aware of any great differences. I think it's, you know, that part of Squirrel Hill is still largely Jewish.
Was it close community? Did you feel like...
Well, you see, it really,
you know,
wasn't part of a community, because by that time I was in my going into my senior year of college moved. I was very, very busy because I was extremely active on campus. I was president of my fraternity and president of the student body and president even of the YMCA. And so you know, there was no community in my but for my mother it was wonderful because her closest friends, whom I named to you, most of them lived within 1 to 2 blocks. In the Wendover, in that building above the Parkway Pharmacy, and down on Whiteman a little bit. So it was great for my mother, who did not drive, and for my father, too.
I understood there were a lot of Jewish children who went to Fifth Avenue High School. Is that so?
Well, way back.
Not when you were...
When I was there, there were still several families, but already the percentage of whites was something like as I recall, 35 to 40%, I would say, whites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and the majority were non-Jewish.
They
so
were
you could,
non-Jewish.
Oh, yeah, oh, sure, the majority were non-Jewish. Italian, Irish, you know, American, some Slavic families. No. So there were. Quite a few Jews. I mean, Jews were not rare, but they were at Fifth Avenue High School. I was there from 43 to 48. 43 to 48, 8th grade through the 12th grade.
I see. So you graduated.
There were a lot of Jews. Bunker Stein, Marvin Stein, You know, and then the guys that I played, and they were, you know, all big basketball players and so on. I remember some of these names, Chuck Rosenblum, Marvin Zisman, Jeff Miller, Mary Bernstein. It's funny how I remember these names. Mm-hmm. And then we played basketball at the Iron Cotton Settlement with Ziggy Kahn, you know, who was the great athletic director and wonderful person, and so on. But Jews were not a majority, and they began to trickle off even during those high school years.
They did.
I mean, well, yeah, not in mass droves, but I mean, every night I'd come back, you know, to school in September from the beach, and I'd find, this little girl was no longer there, or this little boy was no longer there. They had moved to Oakland or East Liberty, you know, and that was it. And occasionally, so our Jewish contacts then, when I became 14, 15, and through the remaining high school years, were at the YM and WHA. We would go there. We would play basketball, and we would have some social functions, like on Sunday nights, as I recall, and so on. So that was our outlet to the Jewish world, other than athletic, you know, at the Ikes. But we had no, you know, nobody dated as such in the sense of, you know, going and picking up a girl for the evening. Nobody had cars. Nobody had a car. I really don't remember one car. I don't remember one student having a car. And I don't remember anybody selling marijuana or smoking marijuana.
No.
I remember if a student, so-called, opened up his mouth to a teacher,